262 area code requested some Robert Palmer, the late, great Robert Palmer, with Every Kind of People on Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, Triple Play Thursday. So we got two more Robert Palmer songs that we're going to hear. One of the best voices ever, and the guy's gone. He was great. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. I'm your overnight dude from 2 to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. 5 o'clock is Steve Grzanich in the opening bell, and then at 6 o'clock is the great Steve Cochran for your morning drive. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, Triple Play Thursday, 312-981-7200. You can also check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. But the best way to stay connected is to like us on Facebook, where we have over 12,000 fans on our Facebook page, and we appreciate that. And it's constantly updated. It's interactive. It's happening right now, facebook.com/Nick D Show. And if you go to facebook.com/Nick D Show right now, you will see a link to my guest's website. He comes on the show regularly. He's been a friend of mine for many years. His name is Dmitry Samarov, and former cab driver, now a writer and artist, and visits with us to talk about some of the things he's doing as we speak. Dmitry, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
How are you, man?
Not bad.
Yeah?
Not bad.
Keeping busy?
Yep.
All right. Now, just a quick background on you. You and I met because you listened to the show, and you would some because I don't drive.
Right, and I would pick you up after your shift would end and take you wherever you were going.
Yeah. And
it became a regular thing, and then you started inviting me in here to talk.
Right, because you are an artist.
Right.
And and then eventually you wrote a couple of books about your experiences as a cab driver.
Yep.
And you drove a cab for how long again?
12 years.
12 years.
Three in Boston and nine in here in Chicago.
Three in Boston and nine in Chicago. And, you know, I just really quickly want to mention, because, like, the world of cab driving and the world of transportation in that kind of realm has completely changed since you left. But it was on the verge of changing because you did some Uber stuff, correct?
I did. They recruited me. They came to Chicago in the spring of 2012, which was my last few months, and they recruited me because I think they'd heard of my book. And they were getting cab drivers to try out the Uber app.
Mm-hmm.
They gave me an iPhone with the app on it. Mm-hmm. And I used it. They barely had any customers at that point.
Right.
And, you know, they're on the verge of taking over the whole industry.
Yeah.
Well, them and the other competitors like Lyft and the other ones.
Yeah.
There's you know. So, but, yeah, some version of that, I'm convinced, is what taxis will be.
At some point.
I mean, I've seen ads on the train, on the CTA, where now Uber is financing cars. They're leasing cars. So they're basically doing the same thing that cab companies do.
Exactly.
Just with a high tech.
Now, did you think when you first, you know, when you were testing out this app, what did you think of it? Did you think that it would explode the way it's exploding?
I thought it was absolutely the future then. Yeah. And the cab companies just thought that things would stay the same forever. But I mean, the last few years that I drove, half my fares were texting me directly. So I was basically some version of Uber, and they would pay. We would decide on a price. Sometimes it wouldn't have anything to do with the meter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was just a matter
of
time.
I texted you quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Yeah, and you and I had some sort of layaway plan for time.
Yeah, there were times.
Like, if you were short.
Like,
you just pay me next week.
Yeah.
And that's how it works now.
Yeah.
I mean, there's tons of problems with Uber, which are very well documented.
Yeah.
It's a crappy company, but run by a creep. But but the idea of it, where you know, a person can just punch in their location,
just pick up the phone
on their smartphone.
Yeah,
yeah. I see them all night at the bar that I work at.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody calls a cab; they all call Uber.
Yeah, I mean, I've got the app. I have the Uber app on my phone, and I've told you before I had some difficulty with it because I couldn't figure out the mm-hmm. GPS thing, and I was like, screw it. But you know, I'm sure at some point I know anybody can use it, and you know.
Well, not everybody actually. I can't because I don't have a smartphone.
Oh, that's
anymore.
Right. You have my old phone that I had
that I had for
many years. That's right.
This amazing piece of 2005.
Yep.
You know
that is exactly the phone technology. That's exactly the phone that I had.
Yep, it's an LG. I think it's called an Envy or something,
mm-hmm.
Or something, but. Yeah, I cannot use Lyft or Uber because it requires a smartphone.
Right.
So I actually, on the rare occasions that I do call a cab, which is at the bar when I'm too tired to walk or ride my bike home.
Yeah,
it's a taxi.
Okay. Know? All right. Well, Dimitri is here, now, Dimitri, you are reviewing books for the Tribune. You're writing columns for the Reader and all that cool stuff.
Yep.
And we love to have you come in to talk about what you've been writing about. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about a couple of the book reviews that I've recently done. Fascinating. Dude named Joe Gould.
Oh yeah, Joe Gould's Teeth.
Yeah,
great book.
I wasn't really aware of who Joe. I had heard who Joe Gould was, but I really wasn't aware of who he was, and then started to read about him until I saw Stanley Tucci's movie,
Joe Gould's Secret,
which I really love.
Yeah,
and
it's based on Joseph Mitchell's writing for The New Yorker.
Right,
and Stanley
and
Tucci directed
plays
Joseph
Mitchell. Yeah. Ian Holm plays Joe Gould.
Yeah.
And I really like that movie a lot. I thought it was great. And then mm-hmm. I read about Joe Gould. He's a fascinating guy. And yes. There is now a new book about Joe Gould out called Joe Gould's Teeth.
Yeah, by a writer named Jill Lepore, who I believe teaches at Harvard. She's an academic, but she writes pretty readable, popular-type books. And she decided to go back and kind of separate fact from fiction about this crazy bohemian guy named Joe Gould, who claimed to be writing an oral history of his time, and was seen scribbling in notebooks all over New York, and made friends with people like Ezra Pound and all these luminaries of the art and literature world. But it turns out, likely didn't write anything but gibberish. Mm. And he would stow these notebooks filled with his scrawl, like with all these friends, and then claim that there was other ones in other places. So he was sort of a fabulist, but he had a lot of people believing his story. For whatever reason, people just couldn't resist.
And the question here, and you bring this up in your review of the book, and I want to talk more about the book, what you thought of it, everything. But the question here, was this guy... was he gifted but strange, or just a loon?
Yeah,
that's like the main question. Did this guy really have a gift, or was he just nuts?
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be the question. That has been about this guy. Like any of the writings or the film itself, that's the main question: is this guy just a lunatic?
Yeah,
or was he just an eccentric, very very eccentric, and really really talented, and really did write this oral history?
Well, he really tapped into this. This image that I think has captivated people probably in all times of this mad genius.
Yes.
That the guy on the corner, like screaming at the sky, actually has some sort of insight that us sane, normal people just don't have access to. And he had enough charm or enough lucidity at times to make people buy it.
Mm-hmm. Now, how was the book?
It's great. I mean, I think I read it in about 2 days.
Mm.
Yeah, I read it really quickly. It was it's just a lot of fun. But even this woman who, spent months and months in libraries and digging through archives couldn't help but be charmed by this guy and would not write him off as just an insane person.
Mm-hmm.
That she just couldn't completely write off. That maybe he had access to some sort of magic, at least intermittently, at least just every once in a while.
And I've not read this book. I've read about Joe Gould in the past, and I've seen the movie, and that seems to be consistent in whoever is writing about him.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like you acknowledge the fact that this guy was probably nuts, but there's something there. And you're right. I mean, the word is charmed.
Yeah.
And that's the tone of the movie, of Tucci's movie, is that you're charmed by this guy, but he's clearly got a screw loose.
Yeah, and then there's a dark side revealed. One of the things that she dug up in the book was he harassed this woman, this black sculptress, incessantly for like a decade, at least a decade. He was convinced that she was the love of his life. He harassed her and like showed up places, and she repeatedly told him not to bother her, that she didn't want anything to do with him.
Right. And that crossed the line from eccentricity to like dangerous.
Yeah, she fled New York because of him, apparently. Mm. Yeah. And he would also do this to hit up, he would hit up all his patrons for contribution to the Joe Gould Fund,
Right.
And Yeah, he would just show up at people's doorstep and demand either money or sex or food or whatever was, like, he had exacting demands at various times. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't just a magical elf.
Right. You know, yeah, exactly.
Tracing around the city.
And so you would recommend this book?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it was a great book.
Okay, very, very cool. Yeah. And where did he – tell everybody how – well, he's dead. He died. But he died, and it was a sad death for Joel Gould. He ended up in a mental institution.
Yeah, he died in a sanatorium, yeah. I think – was it on Long Island? Yeah, he had to be committed eventually. He was not able to take care of himself out in the world. Mm-hmm. She speculates that he was – I mean, the treatments at the time included shock therapy and possibly lobotomy. She couldn't find exact records, but she found very similar people presenting with similar symptoms, kind of delusions mm-hmm. and of grandeur, etc. And it's very likely the people that saw him in his last days, he was sort of like a shadow of his former self.
Yeah.
And now he'd sort of given up.
Did you form a personal opinion of Joel Gould by reading this, or did you form an opinion of what you thought the author thought of him? Did it influence the way that you felt about Joel Gould?
There was a lot of details that I hadn't heard before, especially the stuff about this woman that he harassed.
Yeah.
It gave a fuller picture. I suspected all along that there was really nothing to this oral history that he claimed to be writing, or nothing coherent anyways, but...
Does she at all say, does she come to the conclusion at all that, like, at the end of the book, does she say, you know, it would be great someday if someone found these?
Well, over the years, there was multiple searches. People would really get obsessed with this story, including her. She went to many states, all the references she could find. She reached out to people overseas that had some of these notebooks or claimed to. And all the stuff that she found, she could not trace any coherent narrative mm-hmm. through this stuff. There was a lot of lists and there was a lot of repetition. Because apparently what would happen is he would stash some notebook and then he would forget what he had written and he would start over again. He was an intelligent person, but he was somebody that couldn't string together a coherent narrative.
Yeah.
He attended Harvard. He didn't finish, but he attended. Mm-hmm. This wasn't an idiot.
Right. Well, anyway, and the book is called Joel Gould's Teeth.
Yes.
And the author is?
Jill Lepore.
Lepore. Okay. And it's out now.
Yes.
Okay, cool. All right, Dmitry, hang on. Dmitry Samarov is with me. You can check out DmitrySamarov.com. We have a link on our Facebook page, and we'll talk more with Dmitry coming up. Some like it hot, so let's turn up the heat till we fry. Ah, yeah. Triple Play Thursday, man. Yeah, Triple Play Thursday continues. This is Power Station, man. Robert Palmer, 262, picked Robert Palmer, the artist, and this is with him with Power Station, Some Like It Hot. And when I saw Power Station live in 85 or 86, Robert Palmer did not sing with them. We were stuck with Michael DeBars. Who was Dimitri's here? Mike, have you ever heard of Michael DeBars?
Who was he?
DeBars was a British rock singer who would bounce around from band to band. Okay. And in Power Station was this. Do you remember? You don't remember Power Station, do you?
That was Duran Duran.
It was like a couple guys from Duran Duran, a couple guys from Chic, and Robert Palmer, and they recorded a one-off album. It was just and it became huge, and they toured. And I went to see them, but Robert Palmer didn't tour, so they got Michael DeBars. Michael DeBars is best known as being the husband of Pamela DeBars, who wrote the famous book about being in a groupie.
The groupie woman. Okay.
So he's not really known for his musical taste or his talent. He's known because his wife wrote a book about sleeping with Jimi Hendrix and all those other guys.
Well, I'm sure he's immensely proud.
Well, this is hard to believe, but he actually showed up in an episode of Seinfeld. He's in an episode, like Michael DeBars is in an episode of Seinfeld. where
I'm sure he'll be playing Ribfest somewhere this summer.
Yeah.
But, you know, this stuff never goes away. I just saw a listing in the Reader for the original lineup of Culture Club playing in town sometime this summer.
Yeah.
I mean, it just...
Yeah.
They just won't die.
Yeah. All right.
Nostalgia never goes away.
Let's talk a little bit more here about it's you wrote a piece about this the show on FX called Maron.
Oh yeah, Mark Maron's show.
Yeah, Mark Maron, who I think is great and very funny. And you talk about, you know, he's one of these guys in the piece that you wrote in reviewing the first few episodes of the new season of Maron, which just started on FX. The show has kind of taken a turn, but you set it up in the piece that you wrote. You set it up that he is really one of the most revealing interviewers and comedians out there. Like, he talks a lot in detail about his
life. Well, his, you know, for anybody who's hasn't heard of Mark Maron, he's got the most popular podcast in the world, basically, called WTF with Mark Maron.
Right.
And it airs, he puts two out a week, and he has for about 5 or 6 years now.
Yep.
With basically every famous or notable person you could think of has been on the show. I mean, skewed towards comedy, but I mean, he's had President Obama on.
Mm.
That's the reach of Mark Maron. I mean, to me, he's basically the Tonight Show of this generation, as far as relevance. But then, but every show begins with about 20 minutes or half an hour of him sharing whatever is bothering him, which is a multitude of things. Usually he's a very neurotic man.
Yes he is
so then a few years ago, when he started this half-hour scripted show called Maron, based on his life, where he plays himself or some version of himself,
it was
a bit of a letdown because it was so restrained. And there's this thing where comedians are often show up on sitcoms playing versions of themselves, and they're not actors.
Well, that, you know, it's true. And that's become like an actual subgenre.
Yeah.
There have been several of these shows, including shows that are on right now.
Yeah.
Not just Maron's show.
Yeah.
There's a show called Lady Dynamite with Maria Bamford, which is on Netflix.
I just saw the first one. It's pretty amazing.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. All 12 episodes are great, Dimitri. It's great.
Oh, you've seen all of them?
Yeah. Wow. I binge watched the whole thing.
Yeah.
And because I love Maria Bamford. I think she's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And you know what they do in terms of narrative and storytelling on that show is really challenging, because people might watch the first episode and go, what is going on? What's happening here? But that Dice has one where he's playing himself.
Yeah.
David Hasselhoff has one.
Louis, of course.
Louis. Yeah. You know, and it all kind of really kicked off with Curb Your Enthusiasm, like that.
I guess so. As a
subgenre, or at least a popular
Seinfeld,
subgenre.
Seinfeld, of course.
Seinfeld, yes. Yeah. You know, but it, now it's like everybody has one.
But
Rob Schneider has one on Netflix.
But there's often this thing where it's a sitcom, or a lot of them. Some of them are more standard than others. But Mark Maron's is a fairly straight ahead sitcom with a bunch of actors and some other comedian friends.
Yeah,
and him in the middle, and he's not an actor.
Right.
So there's this problem where it's. He's playing himself, but it's this super restrained version, because anybody who has listened to him talk on a mic knows all these things about him that are not revealed in this show.
Right.
Or they're like the PG versions.
Right.
And it's sort of a letdown.
And it is. I mean, as a fan, I don't listen to the podcast regularly. Uh-huh. I've heard it, and I admire Mark Maron. I think he's great. I think he's one of the most brilliant guys in comedy today.
Great live, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He is great.
And he does his stand-up is really the seat of the pants kind of improv. Like, he's just reacting, doing stuff off the cuff.
Yeah. And he's great at it.
But a half-hour scripted TV show is the polar opposite of that.
Right. Now, I've not seen the new season yet, but you bring up in your piece here that, like, as someone who is a fan and who listens and knows all of the stuff that he talks about and all the details— it's kind of a letdown to watch the show until now, because things are going kind of off the rails from his life in the sitcom.
Yeah, in the last couple of episodes of the third of last season, he basically has a meltdown. He has a mental breakdown, And in the beginning of this one, he's suddenly addicted to Oxy and living in a storage locker. So these are things that we all know are not happening to Marc Maron. And that suddenly makes the show a lot more interesting.
Right.
Because he's making stuff up. And it's pretty hilarious that a comedian that's known for oversharing succeeds on his own show by making stuff up.
Yeah. And that seems to be the direction it's going in this season or so far?
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of come back down to earth. So he goes to rehab, and he's come out of rehab, and he's, like, living with his mom in Florida. And his mom is played by, I'll remember in a second, really prominent actress, Sally Kirkland.
Really?
His mom, yeah.
Wow.
And, she's pretty great.
Yeah.
But that she's been on before. She's been on in previous seasons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Michael Lerner plays her boyfriend, who's like the most annoying man in the world.
That's great. Well, it's interesting that's the kind of direction that it's taken now. Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
So, that was an interesting. So I wrote a bit about that for the Reader.
Right. And that was in the Reader
last week, I think?
Last week was in the Reader. Yeah. And it's about Marc Maron now making stuff up on the season 4 of the show.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Cool. You guys can read all this stuff at the Reader website and at DmitrySamarov.com. And I also want to mention quickly before we break with the news, people can check out your art on your website, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
all right,
many,
cool.
many examples.
All right, we will talk about that coming up, too. All right, we got a break here. We got the news coming up next. It's Dmitry Samarov is with me, and we'll talk more. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. All right. Nick DiGilio, welcome back to the show. 262 area code for Triple Play Thursday here. Picking some Robert Palmer. That was Bad Case of Loving You. It's Nick DiGilio here, and coming up after 4 o'clock, we will play another round of Would Esmeralda Buy That? And that's coming up. We'll see if Esmeralda would actually buy some of these weird items that we've picked out. And these are real items, too, and we'll describe them. And if you want to see them, see what they look like, they'll be posted on our Facebook page when we start to play the game. And hopefully Vic will be able to get a couple of right this morning. So we're rooting for you, Vic. So, all right. And we also have Dmitry Samarov here live in studio with me. We mentioned some of your art is available at DmitrySamarov.com.
Mm-hmm.
You also have a show up right now.
I do. I have a show currently up at a wine bar and restaurant called Rootstock, which is in Humble Park. It's at the corner of California and Augusta. I don't remember the exact address, but
it's called Rootstock.
It's called Rootstock, easily searchable on the
and,
web.
And is now the stuff that's being shown right now, that of course is for purchase. People can
absolutely,
yeah.
Everything is for purchase.
Everything is
all
for purchase
time.
All
yeah.
the time. And
yeah.
If you're interested in it, DmitrySamarov.com. We have a link on our Facebook page. And what medium do you mostly work in?
I go all over the place. This show that's at this restaurant, Rootstock, they're large pieces. They're charcoal drawings and then ink paintings. These are all black and white. But I also do oil paintings. I do watercolor. I do pen drawings. All kinds of stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. And
all media.
All of it is there at DmitrySamarov.com. Right. You actually did a portrait of me that I did. That
and
I love.
I'm actually currently working on another portrait series for another show that'll start in August.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I'm kind of knee-deep in portraits these days.
All right.
It's one after the other.
All right, very, very cool.
Yeah.
So anyway, you can get the artwork. It's all available, and you can check it out at DmitrySamarov.com. Now, the reason I wanted to bring that up was to segue into the next piece that you wrote about the MFA show. Of the artists,
Yeah, a few. This is a few weeks back.
Yeah, a few weeks back. It's not running. It's closed now. It's
I think it's done.
It said here on your piece that it was through the 18th of May. But I found the piece to be really interesting.
Did you read any of the comments that were left?
No. Okay. I'm sure it did. Well, tell everybody about the piece and what you did, because you went to the School of the Art Institute.
I got a Bachelor of Fine Arts from the School of the Art Institute many years ago now, in 1993. But so every year they have a graduate thesis show, the MFA show. They also have a BFA show, but I haven't gone in about a decade. And since I'm writing for The Reader pretty regularly these days, I figured it would be a good motivation for me to make it to one of these shows.
To go back.
Yeah. If I got them to pay me a little bit of money to write about it.
Yeah.
So I went, and it was, you know, about 95% crap, as it always is.
Mm-hmm.
These shows are always this way. And I wrote about it. I liked a couple of things I wrote about that. And
well, the thing that I found really interesting about the piece was just you talked about how the displays were just so poorly put together, and it was just like 2x4s, and it looked, and
there was some shoddy sort of presentation.
Yeah,
because. In art school these days, craft isn't really stress. It's more idea than anything. You have an idea, and then how it's put together is sort of beside the point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that. Once you have your brilliant idea, that's the part that really counts.
Mm-hmm.
for a lot of stuff that comes out of art school these days.
Now, you said that it lacked cohesiveness because there were no attributions or nameplates or anything on the wall, or
I saw the show before it actually officially opened, so not all the signage was there, but it's a hodgepodge. These shows are always hodgepodges because, I mean, there's over 100 artists displayed, each one of them for 2 years. You know, the MFA program is 2 years. They've been in their studios working on their own stuff. They're not working to sort of match up to their colleagues or their classmates. They're just doing their own stuff.
Right.
And then when you present it all together, it's just like a crazy quilt.
Yeah.
Things clash all the time. Although apparently, at least as far as on the show's website, there were apparently curated sections of it. So there was supposed to be some kind of thematic unity, but
there was.
That's what they said. I didn't catch it that much of it. That seems like an impossible task to me anyway. So I didn't fault the show for that exactly. That's just the nature of the beast.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find that you liked?
So, yeah, I liked a couple of things, and the stuff. So there was this woman named, I'm going to butcher her name. What was her name?
Is it
her last name is Tarabi?
Okay, Orchida Tarabi.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Who did these kind of portraits? But portraits of sort of anonymous people that look. She's Iranian, and they have very much that the look of some people from that world, and they're just a really. There's something unsettling about them, but they're not specific people either. They're portraits, but they're not portraits of. They're portraits of people that we don't know. They like weird, eerie strangers. So they have a bit of a sideshow kind of quality to them. And for some reason, I kept going back to them. And apparently I wasn't the only one that liked her stuff, because she's gotten a show out, like a show with an actual gallery. Opening, I think, next month.
Wow.
And they're using the stuff I wrote about her as part of their press material.
Oh, is that right?
So at least somebody liked what I wrote about.
Did she contact you at all? Did the artist?
She thanked me.
Yeah.
I actually contacted her because I needed images to use for my article.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't find any online. So, yeah.
All right.
She was happy about it. Other people weren't. But
now, so what were you? I mean, you mentioned the comments about this piece. What were they?
there was a comment from a professor from the Art Institute, which is very, very indignant, and saying that seeing my negative attitude towards the school and higher learning in general, I should have been disqualified from reviewing the show.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Now, was this a professor that you knew? that no. he wasn't there when you were there.
It was a she, but no.
A she.
No. I guess this is some of her students, and she was jumping to their defense, which is very admirable.
yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's that. Was it weird going back to it?
It's funny how little stuff changes in a certain way.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Also, the other problem with the show is now that they hold it in the Sullivan Galleries, which is part of the old Carson Peary Scott building.
Oh, right.
One of the top floors there. I think it was the 7th or 10th floor.
Yeah.
And this is one of the most beautiful buildings in the city of Chicago. And to me, like, there's whatever you put into it would pale in comparison to the building itself and the views out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You see State Street out of the windows mm-hmm. and stuff. It's sort of set up to fail in a certain way for student art, you know? But that's just my point of view.
Okay. And now do you ever keep in touch with anybody that you were going to school with or anybody who taught?
My friend Frank, who I lived with briefly, he was a classmate of mine. We just met up Tuesday. We went to the MCA actually to see the Kerry James Marshall show, which is an amazing show.
Mm-hmm.
He's this incredible painter who lives in Chicago, and this is my second time going back to the show.
Oh wow!
I sort of regret I didn't get to write about that show.
What style?
He's got his own style. You kind of have to see it to believe it. I don't even know how to describe it, but the show's called Mastery, and it basically he's been chronicling like the African American experience in his own way. My favorite series that he did was he did this series about public housing called like the Garden series. So the you know how a lot of the public housings were named gardens,
yes.
Like Altgeld Gardens, Rockwell Gardens. So he did a whole series of these giant paintings with monumental figures, and it's just they're really powerful paintings.
Mm. So your friend Tony, you went with him to see that. You keep in touch with him,
Frank.
I'm sorry, Frank. Yeah. And you keep in touch with him.
Yeah, I do. You know, see Tony Fitzpatrick every once in a while.
Yep.
Yeah. Who else? From school, that my friend Frank, a couple other people now and then, not too much else. I mean, it's a long time ago now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
But, yeah, I don't know if any of these art reviews I've been doing for the Reader gaining me in you know, promoting my art career in any way.
Really. Well, I mean, you wrote about Dolly, too.
yeah, I did.
In kind of a negative way. You took on Salvador Dali.
Well, that was, I will, in my defense, that was assigned to me. I didn't pitch that one. A lot of the articles I write for the Reader, I pitch the subject.
Mm-hmm.
But Dali, my editor there, Tal Rosenberg, for some reason, maybe because he's got a weird sense of humor, like insisted that I go and review this show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though I told him, you know, beforehand that I didn't think much of Dolly.
Right, right. But I like this. You know, I like.
I tried. I gave it the old.
No,
college
I know you gave it the old college. No pun intended. but I know, and it's. But it, I like the way you know, the positives that you did put on it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought were interesting. You said because it was one curator, it was you could see. From this curator's perspective,
it's a collection. It's one
his guy's
collection.
Yeah, one guy's collection.
Yeah.
You see that makes it cohesive, and it's interesting to see what this person chose.
Yeah,
and also you know you acknowledge that this stuff was done. This show consists of mostly stuff that was done in the '60s, and you said at that point Dolly was just cruising. You know,
he's a caricature of himself, and this is a caricature of a guy that started out as a caricature. So
yeah.
it's like one of those. You know, when you get a well, people wouldn't remember that these days. If you made a copy of a copy of a copy,
yeah.
that's what a lot of this stuff.
I remember.
Was, yeah, you
I
would
remember. I do. I remember. But I thought that the Dolly piece was pretty interesting. Is that show still running?
It might be. It probably is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you got you know a couple hundred thousand dollars, you're welcome to buy some stuff from there.
Oh wow, really?
Well, the stuff that I like the tapestries, they were over $100,000, I think.
Each,
yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Dali's still making money for people. So,
okay, well, those are a couple of interesting pieces that you wrote. These were both for the Reader, Dali and and the MFA show at the Art Institute.
Yep.
Okay. All right, we'll talk some more here with Dmitry Samarov. And, again, you can check out DmitrySamarov.com, but we have a link on our Facebook page, Facebook.com/NickDShow, for all the information about the stuff that Dmitry is writing and about his art and how you can check out all his art. He's got a show going at Rootstock right now in Humboldt Park, and we'll talk more about some of the stuff that Dmitry's got in, and including a review that he did of a documentary about David Hockney, and we'll get to that and more.
Can't take my eyes off you. Pardon the way that I stare. There's nothing else to compare. The sight of you leaves me weak.
Yeah. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Nick DiGilio here, and it's Triple Play Thursday. Three songs by one artist. You pick them. 815 area code texted in at 312-981-7200 to request for Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. Can't take my eyes off of you. Every time I hear that song, I think of The Deer Hunter. Every time. I do. There's a great scene in the movie where the guys sing along to that song while they're shooting pool. In The Deer Hunter. Dmitry Samarov is with me. Hello, Dmitry.
Hi.
How are you? All right. Welcome back. I want to talk a little bit about this documentary that you wrote about called Hockney.
Sure.
And tell everybody who David Hockney is. Tell everybody about the movie. And it was playing at the Siskel Center, but now it's playing in Wilmette at the Wilmette Theater, if you want to see it.
Well, David Hockney, he's still alive. He's one of the most successful living artists. He's British. Started in the 60s, paints a lot of portraits and a lot of sort of scenes of easy living, lush kind of. He's been based in California for a very long time. Lush, opulent, kind of colorful paintings. And there's this documentary, this feature-length documentary that just came out called Hockney, which is just... What it reminded me of more than anything else is sort of lifestyles of the rich and famous. So there's a lot of, you know, realtors would go gaga over this. Like, there's a lot of incredible real estate in this movie.
Yeah.
But I just came away. I watched the movie twice, hoping to sort of see past the surface of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie, and the filmmakers seem intent on sort of replicating the lushness and ease and opulence of David Hockney's artwork rather than figuring out much of what the root of it is.
And what makes him tick.
Or any of the trouble behind it, because there's just no way that this guy's life has been as easy as this movie presents. Because this is a guy who he grew up like towards the end of World War II in a working class kind of dying industrial town in England in the time of rationing, you know, when chocolate was a treat, like you'd get like once a month or something.
Mm-hmm.
And a man who was openly gay and flamboyant in the 60s, there was all these things that were, there was no way it wasn't difficult. And in this movie, he was just tiptoeing through the tulips. It was just like one enchantment after another. And I don't know what the point of that is. I guess if you've never heard of David Hockney, maybe it's a good introduction, but I have to react to it as someone who's, you know, been making art for 30 years and know something about, you know, what it takes to have a long career, and you put everything that you are into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't believe that this guy is that one-dimensional. Yeah.
So the filmmaker is Randall Wright.
Yeah.
And clearly the filmmaker is a massive fan of Hockney's.
Yeah.
It's like a hero worship thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's and everybody, every talking head that's interviewed has nothing but nice things to say about David Hockney. And I'm sure David Hockney is a lovely man. You know, I don't want to cast any aspersions on him, but there's, if you're going to make a feature length documentary about a guy that, you know, it's not like if he was an unknown artist and you wanted to do the guy a solid and, let people know about him. I could sort of see doing something this positive.
Yeah.
But somebody that does not need any help with sales or, I mean, he's set.
Clearly.
He's doing fine. I don't know what the point.
What were the interviews like with him in it? Did he reveal anything or was it,
Not too much. Not too much. I didn't mention this in the review, but throughout the film, there's these captions, which are, I guess, sayings of his, which are just I can't reproduce any of these, but they're like the most obvious kind of daily affirmation kind of things.
Yeah.
I'm not quite like Reach for the Stars, but like stuff
that.
Like that.
It's in that camp.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I was very puzzled.
Do you know the background of the filmmaker at all?
No, I don't know anything about the filmmaker.
Yeah.
No. But you know, in a feature length film, a profile about an artist, I was hoping for more.
Okay.
A little more depth.
Well, I mean, if people are interested, if you're a fan of David Hockney's,
yeah.
As you said, perhaps if you are, a big fan of David Hockney's, you could appreciate this more than, you did.
Well, if you know nothing about David Hockney,
yeah.
It might be a good introduction.
Right.
If you're somebody who knows David Hockney's work and wants to find out more, you won't find out more from this movie. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. But it is playing at the Wilmette Theater exclusively now. It was playing, as we said, at the Siskel Center. But now it's at the Wilmette Theater, exclusively at the Wilmette Theater, and it's called Hockney. Dimitri wrote about that for the Reader as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you can check that out at the Reader. So what are you working on now? Are you reading a book or two?
I am. I'm reading this amazing oral history about the end of the Soviet Union, written by Svetlana Alexievich, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature last year. And her life's work is basically documenting the former Soviet republics, and this is what she's been doing.
When was this assigned to you, or did you pitch this?
I pitched this
one. Yeah, I figured that.
I pitched this one, and that's for the Trib. Yeah, it's massive. It's like a 400-page book. But what it is just people's voices. And it just underlines what a severely, severely troubled country Russia is, yeah. Always has been, and always will be, because, half the people are nostalgic for, Stalin and for communism. And
yeah.
they've completely forgotten how horrible the Soviet Union was, and they want back. They want things to be back the way they used to be.
Okay. All right. So you're working on that as well.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
That and a bunch of artwork. And
you're now bartending.
Yep. Bartending Sunday nights.
Cool.
At the Skylark. Come by. I'll pour you a drink.
Dimitri, thanks, man.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll talk to you soon. Dimitri Samarov, great artist, great writer, good friend. DimitriSamarov.com. Thanks for coming by. We will take a break. We got the news coming up next.